WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cicely Bach is best known for her books on the ethics of lying and keeping secrets. But her latest book is more personal. It's a memoir about her mother, and it's now out in paperback. Bach is the daughter of Gunnar and Alva Myrdal, the only husband and wife team to each win a Nobel Prize in different fields. He won for economics, she won the Peace Prize for her work on disarmament. Many of the dilemmas women are facing today, Alva Myrdal faced and wrote about in the 40s and 50s. She had a career of international scope while raising three children. Myrdal was one of the architects of Sweden's family and social policies. She was Sweden's ambassador to India and head of the UN's Department of Social Affairs. Her responsibilities often took her away from her family. Cicely Bach was born in December of 1934, just about a month after the publication of her parents' controversial book, Crisis in the Population Question. The book put her parents at the center of national debates about families, contraception, and child care. And all of Sweden seemed to be interested in how the Myrdals would bring up their own children. Cicely's birth was covered in the Stockholm newspapers.
They regarded it as something of a scandal because the book was something of a scandal. Here was a woman who was actually signing her name to a book that talked about sexuality, about family planning, contraceptives, all kinds of things that in those days, Puritan Sweden did not think women should be talking about at all, preferably not men either.
Do you think your mother was self-conscious about how she brought you up, knowing that she was in the public eye?
I think she cared a lot about bringing up children, but I don't think the fact that she was in the public eye altered how she was doing it. She had established a school for training nursery school teachers, and she cared a great deal about how one might raise children to be happier individuals, and in particular how one might raise girls not to develop all the feelings of incompetence and weakness that she saw so many girls having. And of course, she herself had been brought up to think that she couldn't do all kinds of things because she was a girl and she shouldn't really try to do them.
Did she do things differently with you than other mothers of the time did with their daughters so that you wouldn't feel inferior by virtue of being a woman?
It certainly seemed that way, both to my sister and to myself. We had a sense that our upbringing was just much freer in many ways. And we knew that other people looked at us, in fact, as rather badly brought up because we didn't really always act just the way little girls were supposed to act. We didn't seem to care enough about dolls and we didn't seem to care enough about pretty clothes, for instance. So we did know that there was a difference, but we always thought that we were very well off in that sense.
Your mother became a writer and a thinker at a time when there were very few women who were doing that and also having families. And she was really way ahead of her time in having to figure out how to have both a career and a family. And you write about how all the women who she knew of who were scholars never married and never had children. So they didn't have to make those kinds of choices.
Right. I mean, those were the women that she did admire for having done something with their lives. But on the whole, they had had no children, even if they had been married, and most of them definitely had not married either. And she just knew that she wanted to have a different kind of life. She really did want to have a family very much. She did want to have children. But she had absolutely no models that she could think of for women who had done both and done so creatively. And in her own family, her mother in particular was very afraid of sexuality and afraid of having children, in part because her mother had died in childbirth at the age of 31. And so my mother's mother, terrified in this way, actually had five children but was very resistant to the whole idea and spent a lot of time, especially later in her life, in bed, partly so as to avoid her husband and all kinds of family responsibilities. And my mother was just sure that she didn't want to lead her life that way. But that's where family planning came in again and contraception. She didn't want to be in the situation where she might end up having innumerable children. She wanted to be able to have have a life in which she could decide when the children would fit in and how that would work with being employed. But of course, then she found out that however carefully you plan, there are many, many complications about trying to do both.
Well, early on in her life as a mother, she made a decision that I think she was always unsure about, that she always in some ways regretted. This was before you were born, but your mother's first son, Jan, or is it Jan?
Jan,
thank
yes.
you. Mm-hmm. He was 2 years old when your mother had the opportunity to go with your father to New York for research?
Yes.
And she decided to go and to leave her son at his grandparents' house in the country, thinking that that would really be good. But what was the problem?
Well, the problem was that you know, obviously it cut her links in many ways with this little boy, and she knew in her heart of hearts that she shouldn't perhaps have left him. On the other hand, she was dying to go to America. She and my father had both been offered fellowships to study in this country, and that was very unusual at the time. She was 27 years old, and she was terribly torn, and my father insisted that she come without the little boy. And nowadays, you know, I think it would have been much easier to think through the problem and to think of all we know now about that two-year-old stage when children really need to bond in a way with their parents. And I think most of us would not make the same choice. But she was very torn. She later thought it had been a terrible mistake, but she did it at the time. And once she came to America, she loved her opportunity to study and do research.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Sissela Bock, and she's the author of books about the ethics of lying and keeping secrets. But her new book is a memoir about her mother, Alva Myrdal, the Swedish writer, diplomat, and Nobel Peace Prize winner. I think our view of relationships is often framed by watching our parents and by watching the kind of conflicts they have with each other. Now, your mother watched her parents' battles about the conflict between sexuality and having more children. Your mother didn't want to, your grandmother didn't want to just keep having more children, and she was very wary of having sex because of that. What were the battles between your parents that you watched and that helped frame your idea of relationships?
Well, one, and perhaps the most important, probably had to do with how one relates to one's children. I could see that there was my mother struggling so hard both to have close relationships and indeed friendships with her children, and on the other hand also help and be close to this man who demanded fantastic amounts of attention, and that was my father. And he was in many ways, she always thought, a genius, and a genius required very special kinds of help. He was temperamental, he could be depressed, he could be elated. She knew how much she could help him, and she knew that he essentially wanted her all to himself, and he did not want her to spend very much time at all with the children. In fact, though he was a feminist, and I think that's very important for me to stress, he always supported her work, and he always supported other women who wanted to do things. But at the same time, he did not think that they should have children. He thought that a bright, talented woman should dedicate herself totally to her work, and if there was a husband, also to the husband, but not particularly to the children. And seeing that, I just knew that I could never lead that kind of life. I'd rather not marry at all than marry someone who demanded that kind of divorce from my children, from me. And of course, she didn't carry it out either. She really tried to do everything. She didn't succeed always, but I think she did pretty well.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sissela Bock, and she's best known for her books about the ethics of lying and keeping secrets. Her new book is a memoir about her mother, Alva Myrdal, the Swedish writer, diplomat, and Nobel Peace Prize winner. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Sissela Bock is my guest. Her new book is called Alva Myrdal, A Daughter's Memoir. Your mother wrote that children should feel free and strong and able to resist their parents. How did she feel when you rebelled against her?
I think that again produced a little bit of a surprise for her, not one that made her angry. And in a way, we never rebelled in such a way as to want to make her angry. We went our own way, and I think she was very supportive of that because she specifically argued all the way through, her youth and the years when she was talking about child psychology. She especially argued against the idea that children should be brought up to obey adults no matter what. So I think she was pleased in that sense. At the same time, she obviously thought sometimes that we could have gone in slightly different directions. And then she would always toss out thousands of ideas toward us, ideas about what to study, how to live, how to furnish whatever place we were living in. And that, in turn, was something that we appreciated enormously, I think. She never tried to force us, but she had all these ideas. In particular, I remember one time I talk about a young man that I had actually gotten engaged to at age 17. I now look back at that with some trepidation. At that time, instead of saying anything about the fact that I might be too young or that he might not be the right husband for me forever and ever, she took me instead on one of her trips to England, and we visited Oxford and Cambridge universities, and I ran into a lot of other young men, and I began to put my situation in perspective. But she never, never forced even that situation.
What were the things that you rebelled about in your relationship with your mother?
There was a time, especially in adolescence, when I felt that her brand of competence and being so sensible and knowing so much seemed to shut out what I thought was very important about emotions and poetry and light and darkness and secrets, as I wrote. It didn't seem to me that she spent enough time at all in the almost magical garden where we lived in Geneva. And I just had a kind of dream life that I didn't think she shared. So I wrote in my diary at one point that I never wanted to share her values. As I now look back at that, I realize that I didn't really see her fully at that time, 15, 16, 17. But on the other hand, I think I had to go through that phase before understanding her more fully.
How did your relationship with your mother change when you became an adult?
Well, what happened was I was living in Paris with her when I was 18 and 19. And as I say, I was in this rather sulky mood, but so many things were happening in Paris at the time. The French were winding down their brutal war in Vietnam. There were street battles in which I saw people, Vietnamese and others, bleeding. There were all kinds of marvelous singers like Juliette Gréco. So many things were happening in Paris that I began to think I needed to talk with her about it in spite of my resistance. And then I met, when I was 19, I met Derek Bock, who would then shortly become my husband. And again, I had a sense that now I wanted to share something with her. This was something so extraordinary. And perhaps, after all, I had to grow up. And if I were to grow up, I knew that I would have to have a different kind of relationship with her. Even then, however, I was a bit tentative, and it wasn't until after I had married, and in fact moved to America, and she had gone to India, that my husband asked me how it could be that I was still on a somewhat tentative relationship with her. And then I wrote her a letter where essentially I asked her to forgive me for not having understood her enough. And I think that was an enormous turning point in my relationship with her.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sissela Bock, and her new book is a memoir about her mother, Alva Myrdal. Your parents, before they died, drew up a will that willed all of their money to a foundation for artists and writers. And as you write in your book, they didn't believe in inherited wealth. I wonder how you felt about that, and how you felt, too, knowing that that money wouldn't go to your grandchildren. I mean, to your children, to your parents' grandchildren.
Yes, at the time, I must say, when I heard about this, my father wrote me, and it seemed to me that my parents had every right to do what they wanted. They were not in any sense millionaires, and they had every right to do with the money that they had earned, having started out with nothing in their own lives, or very little. So at the time, that seemed perfectly reasonable, and they had always been enormously generous and continued to be so, in fact, with all the grandchildren. So there was no sense at the time that there was a problem. And most of all, I think, like most people probably, I did not want to think about such things as their passing away and their having a will. It was later that the problem arose when it turned out that this foundation, called a Universal Heir, as I recall, also had received all the photo albums, all the books, all the mementos. And that, we felt, was really a problem because we wanted to save some of those for ourselves and very much for the children. So then we had to go and ask permission of the Universal Heir, who graciously allowed us to go into the storage vault and select things for our children and take away the photo albums and other mementos. And that was problematic, and in a sense that made me realize that I wasn't going to do things quite that way myself.
Your parents both lived into their early 80s, and you write that in the 1980s there were several magazines that did feature articles about your parents, and that these articles created false pictures of your parents' bliss together in their latter years.
Yes, at the time, by that time, my parents had obviously, you know, they'd had many separations, they'd gone through all kinds of ups and downs. They were very supportive to one another in so many ways, but my mother had also had to carve out an existence of her own. So when all these magazine interviews came around and all these headlines suggesting that here was this couple and they were so blissfully happy and they just loved every moment together, my mother felt that that was a false image that was being projected. My father always was very willing to, I mean, he half believed it all, so he was very willing to make it sound that way. And my mother could not at that point very well say, wait a little, to the interviewer, wait a little, by the way, we have our problems too. That didn't seem to fit with her idea of the diplomatic person that she was. So there was a sense of a false mask. And part of what I'm doing in the book, really, is to do what I think she wanted, namely to show that underneath that mask, there was this living, breathing human being who, in fact, you know, was not just part of the perfect couple or the totally accomplished woman who had it all, but an actual human being who had many ideals, many problems, many tensions, and who managed to work many of them out.
Well, speaking of removing the mask, your older brother had written a memoir about your parents that was very negative. I haven't read it. You know, I've just read what you've said about it. But you know, your mother and father left your older brother for a year, left him with his grandparents when he was two, so that they could do research in New York. And I don't know if that contributed to his feelings toward them or not. But I wonder what effect it had on the family to have a memoir that put them into a pretty bad light as parents.
That was a very, very sad time in their lives. My brother had already broken with them in 1967 when my mother was 65 and explained that he really couldn't take any more the tensions, especially with my father and my father's way of very aggressively sometimes teasing him. And my brother had just decided that he had had enough of that. So they were not seeing one another. But I don't think my parents had expected that he would publish this book, which he called Childhood, where he essentially says that not only was there a problem with my father, by the way, it's a novel, but it uses their names.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
Yes. Not only was there this problem with my father, but my mother had been a cold and most unpleasant, most unmotherly parent. My mother learned about that book in the fall of 1982, and it actually appeared just during the same weeks when she found out that she had received the Nobel Prize for Peace. She was 80 years old then, and there she was with her highest ambition in life almost, named having to do with peace, being recognized in this way on the one hand, and on the other hand, her highest ambition in her private life having to do with the family, and when those two seemed to clash so completely. And it was shattering for her. It was very, very hard, and I do talk about that.
Did you ever talk to your brother about it?
I did. I tried many times to have a reconciliation between my brother and my parents. It never worked. And I think both my brother and I have come to the conclusion, after thinking through our various respective books, that we did have very different childhoods. I came along 7.5 years later, and I did not experience what he experienced, and I can't know what he experienced. So in a way, in the book also, I try to be careful not to say what I think about his childhood, but rather to quote him and to quote the various headlines about his book that had quite a devastating effect on my parents.
Why did you want to write this book about your mother?
I wanted to write it in part because of those events that had made her feel that she was not understood in the right way. Most people in Sweden at the time thought she was almost a saint, this woman who has won all these prizes and who does everything so well and who has this perfect marriage and who can do it all. Then there were some people who were very critical. My brother was one, and the headlines made her seem almost like a half-demon. And then there were other people who thought that she was a cold, calculating social engineer. Nothing seemed to fit. And she began to think what she had never thought before, namely that she should write her own memoirs. And just then, she, however, was developing a form of aphasia, of not being able to speak properly and not being able to write properly, so that just when she was getting ready in a way to write her memoirs, she became unable to do so. And she told me in 1984, in the summer of 1984 when I was visiting, that she worried about this, and she said, "What happens if I can't explain anything anymore?" And that's the sentence that my book begins with, and that's the sentence that really set me thinking, maybe there's something I can do about helping in this explaining process. I know I can't do it as she might have, but I might just try anyway. And that's how I started what I think of now as a dialogue, really, but a dialogue with a person who could no longer speak. So it had to be with her letters, her writings, her diary materials that she had given to me, and everything else that I could lay my hands on.
Sissela Bock, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Sissela Bock's memoir about her mother, Alva Myrdal, is now out in paperback. We spoke last year when it was published in hardcover. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.